Radio Vermont, WDEV, takes no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by the House Calls Vermont show host or their guests. The information provided during the House Calls Vermont show is offered only as a public service and should not be used as a substitute for obtaining any professional advice from a licensed professional. WDEV presents House Calls Vermont with host Jim Bradley and Chris West. Each week a new topic specific to building or renovating in the Green Mountains. And your calls. Yes, your calls as well. So please give us a call if you got any questions for the boys. Brought to us in part by RK Miles, a third generation family owned business. Proud to be your local building materials supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. Poly Construction, for over 30 years, known for anything construction, big or small jobs. One call does it all. Polyconstruction.com. That's P-O-L-L-I, construction.com. Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor, 802-793-2002. Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. Sticks and Stuff in Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and in Middlesex. By the way, the boys are going to be broadcasting live from the St. Albans location coming up on Saturday, the 30th of this month. Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com. And Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, for all things basement-y, northernnefoundations.com. Your participation is encouraged. Call the listener line with questions at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 1-877-291-8255. Now, House Calls Vermont with Jim and Chris.
Good afternoon. This is Chris West with my colleague Jim Bradley.
Hello, everybody out there.
And we are back again. This is our second show for this season. Welcome back. Again, just to reiterate, if you have a question or want to call in, give us a call at 802-244-1777. I just want to make a very quick comment about the birds that we just heard. I'd never heard anybody call a sparrow a chunky sparrow. I just wanted to throw that out there. That's a pretty interesting term. Sparrows are pretty small to start with, so I'm just trying to figure that into my bird watching stuff. Chunky, okay. There we go. I was doing some work at 10 Old Stage this week, and if you're interested in the developments of my deep energy retrofit of this 1830s farmhouse in Essex, Vermont, you can go onto our website, our YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/housecallsvermont, and take a look at the updates there. I started actually putting the exterior rigid foam on the exterior of the brick building, and it's going really well. I'm just really excited about that. But Jim called up while I was working over there, and he had a mouthful to share about some roofs he was hearing proposed. So Jim called me up and he said, Chris, and I got 10 minutes about what was wrong with what he was seeing, and he said, we got to talk about this during the show this week. So this week, we're going to be talking about roofs. We've done this before. A lot of these topics are going to be gone over and over just to make sure we get that information to you. Not everybody's listening every weekend. So if this is a repeat and you've digested all the information, then please just stick around and give us a call. Otherwise, Jim, tell me about this roof thing that you called about.
Well, with every pun intended, this is a different slant than what we've talked about before.
We're not talking 0.5 per 12-inch pitch, right?
No. What happens is, and what I find so interesting about this industry and what Chris and I do, it seems like there's clusters of a topic that come to us, whether it be about weatherization. Of course, you can say, well, that's going to happen during the fall. I'm talking about, though, more so failure issues, whether it be a lot of foam insulation failures or a roof assembly question or whatever, or window issues. They all seem to come in these clusters. And so this was talking to us this time. So basically there was just multiple failures that we have seen when it comes to roof assemblies, and then new ones that we're trying to help prevent. And it comes down to...
By new, you mean haven't been built yet in design, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that haven't been built yet. But with that, what's happening is that people don't always respect our climate, and they think that you can do something that shouldn't be done, and it won't fail necessarily today, but it will fail eventually, and sometimes sooner than you think. So it's basically the question of to vent a roof or not vent a roof, or as people would term it as, is it a hot roof or a cold roof?
Right. And what are the definitions of the two? What's a hot roof? Well, a hot roof is a roof that has no venting from the inside sheetrock to the outside shingles or metal roof. There's just stuff. There may even be a gap, an air gap in there, but that is not vented. So there's no way for drying to happen in a roof of that sort. A cold roof, even if it's a slanted roof, is any roof that has a sufficient amount of venting to it. And the classic cold roof is what you have in a colonial, right? A colonial is two stories. There's a ceiling at the top of the second story. That opens up into an attic. That attic is full of insulation, hopefully air sealed. But the actual attic space is cold, right? There's just air moving through there. That can go from – that's a classic cold roof. But we also have slanted roofs, sloped roofs mm-hmm. that we – or cathedrals that are cold roofs where we put a breathing channel in. And so that's kind of the definition between a hot and a cold. A hot roof has no venting and a cold roof has venting.
And so whether the building is existing or it's going to be new construction or even a renovation project, you have to first identify what type of roof do you have, because each one of the building assemblies have different characteristics. Like you could have a traditional gable roof, which is going to look to a lot of people like an A, the shape of the letter A. And then you're going to have hipped roofs where you have different peaks around the roof.
On that type of roof, every overhang is an eave, right? You don't have a gable on a hip
exactly.
roof.
Exactly. A gable wall, that is.
Gable wall, yeah.
You could have a flat roof where people have gone back into this type of design. Architects are starting to love this again because it's basically this long slab of a roof and it's flat. And in Vermont, that doesn't always make sense because it's prone to some issues. There are certain safeguards you can implement, but that's not always done. And so that's a whole debate again, form over function, function over form, which comes first and which should.
And it's also a really big part of any kind of multifamily construction. You're not going to see a lot of non-flat roofs on multifamily or apartment buildings because that's where they put a lot of the mechanicals.
Yeah, and you can also end up on one of those gable roofs having dormers. As Chris would say, dormers are dumb.
Dormers are dumb.
A gambrel-style roof, which looks like an upside-down boat.
Gambrel is usually associated with a barn, right? If you look at it, that people actually only built gambrels originally as barns because it increases the amount of walkable space on the top floor for storage of straw and stuff. Well, people start saying, well, why don't we just do that with our houses? And you can. They're just, you know, hard to get right.
Yep, and then you also have the mansard roof, which you've seen a lot of the older housing stock that we have. It was something that the French had developed. It was a way to avoid taxes.
There was a way to avoid taxes.
Yeah, because you wouldn't put windows up there, and you would get a living space, and it just looks like your roof line, but it was making it taller. And then nowadays, of course, and historically in Vermont, we have been putting windows in those areas.
You'll see a lot of mansard roofs on Victorians, like
yes.
parts of Victorians. And there was a movement in the 1980s for some reason where they started making – it's kind of like on the second floor you get this very steep angled shingled wall that goes up to the roof with windows in it, and that is a classic mansard roof.
The other type of roof that I've seen in Vermont is like a big golf ball, a geodesic dome.
Half a golf ball.
Yeah, exactly.
And those are some of the worst roofs for air sealing and for insulation.
Oh, they're terrible.
Really hard to deal with.
Yep. So with that, you know, you're going to look at the type of roof, but you're also going to look then of what type of attic you have. And when I say attic, most of us think of an open space. So you're going to have a flat roof at the upper floor, whether that's your first floor, second floor, whatever floor. And that's it. And then above that, you're going to have a much bigger space in that attic where a lot of people like to put their Christmas decorations, the other storage materials.
When they're storing them. I mean, they're not going to put their Christmas decorations up there. Sorry.
And so with that, a lot of people unfortunately choose to put mechanicals up there, like their heating equipment, their cooling equipment, because space is limited. We see this a lot, unfortunately, a lot of the ski resorts around here on the housing stock that I've looked at, the more the transient type of housing stock, is that they're going to have these mechanicals in that area, and it helps them grow really, really big icicles that could be from the eave down to the ground.
They'll win the icicle challenge.
Yes, exactly. But that's not what you want to be doing. And so with that, you know, you're looking at this type of an attic assembly, but also when you have a cathedral ceiling, when we're talking about attics, we're talking about anything beyond the sheetrock. So even on a sloped roof, or if let's say you have a log cabin or a tongue and groove ceiling in that area, that's still beyond that last ceiling finish. up into the insulation area is what we're going to be calling the attic assembly as a point of reference.
Sure. So the two classic types, as we just discussed, is that cold roof and that hot roof, whether it's a slope or a flat. Flats are generally easier to insulate and air seal because access is readily available. You just climb up in the attic. You take out whatever was up there that was making it not a good assembly, whether it's, you know, not well air sealed and full of, you know, five layers and piles of insulation. Actually, there's a series of videos that Jim and I have been doing called the audit eavesdropping, where we go into attics and we're doing a whole audit. Actually, they're like four videos per audit. They're about 20 minutes apiece, and one of them was on Isle LaMotte. And the thing I loved about this particular attic is I got up into the attic, and it was just an attic with, I'd say, two layers of fiberglass insulation as, you know, down on the insulation. But then dotted in the attic were these huge piles of insulation, 2, 3, sometimes 4 feet tall. And in that particular 5 foot region, the R value is like 150.
Yeah.
And we see that all the time. So, when you get up into that attic, you need to first look at the actual condition, and the best attics to do that from are attics that you can actually get into. Now, we all know capes, right? Capes are ones that will have an attic space, whether large or small, and then we'll have those slopes. And that's when we start getting into slopes. And I see that we're just about to come up to a break. So go ahead, Jim.
And so with that, we have about 2 minutes. But with that, why this is so important is it's – whether it's a hot roof or a cold roof, is what are you going to do to handle the moisture? Not just the moisture that comes from outside and bulk moisture that is from rain and snow, but also what are you going to do about the vapor diffusion and the vapor drive inside the building to the outside? And that's why building an assembly has to be robust. It has to be functional if you're going to allow the structure to last, if you're going to allow it to be efficient and healthy and safe at the same time. And so if you don't give proper respect to how that moisture is going to be handled, it's going to find its own way. Even in some of the more robust, solid insulation, like foam insulation assemblies, they have ultimate failures because proper attention is not being given to this area.
And one of the things we often say, and you guys, if you've been listening at all, you've heard us say this, is that the reason that we have all of these really old houses hanging around is because they have a lot of ventilation. Like, they're not air sealed at all, right? We've been in houses, farmhouses that are 20 air changes per hour at 50 pascals. And just to get you back on board with what those metrics mean, a brand new house right now has to be no more than 3 air changes per hour, 50 pascals. And 50 pascals is a pressure difference that approximates a 22.5 mph wind blowing against that house. So why don't we have a lot of rot in these old houses? Well, because there's air moving through it, taking that moisture away the whole time. Now that we're making our houses tighter in the envelope, we need to be careful about trapping moisture.
But the building materials have changed too.
That's also
so you have the more robust, if you will, old growth lumber that had been used previously, and now you have a lot more engineered or fast growing lumber as well that is utilized that is more susceptible to moisture problems. And then also what goes next is, and one of the biggest steps is you have to make sure that barrier, that start where your attic starts, whether that's along the slope of a cathedral, whether it's in the flat area, whether it's in the knee walls of a cape, you've got to make sure that is airtight.
And usually that's the drywall is the first layer we're talking about, right? From the inside, you're going to look up at your ceiling or your slope. You're going to see that painted surface of the sheetrock, and that's the beginning of your air barrier.
And making that airtight doesn't mean you put 40 to 50 recessed lights and other type of vents in that assembly and say, I know they're going to get it right. They're going to air seal this thing perfectly, and it will be an airtight hole.
What's interesting is that we were at a blower door test with smoke this past summer with friends of ours at Leach Construction, and they are really conscientious about air sealing. Mm-hmm. And they had recessed lights, and they'd done this entire complicated air sealing around the recessed lights, and it was failing. So you have to get that right, and there are, and the, you know, you know, props to the leeches for asking for that help, and after seeing what was not working with that assembly, changing it up and going with a slightly different way of making sure those cans were air sealed. Mostly what we ask people to do is not to do standard cans, but to do surface mounted lights, which are as good and don't break that air barrier.
But even when you do that, you got to make sure that, you know, you're putting these blue boxes up there, or usually they're blue, in the ceiling, and you're making a penetration. And then when you do other things like an attic hatch, or you're putting a smoke detector in or something like that, you're making a penetration in that attic plane. And this happens along slopes too. And when you do that, you are basically introducing moisture drive into that space. And so if it's not airtight, moisture is going to get in through convection, and it's going to then, once that moisture is in that attic space or that assembly, as soon as it hits a cold surface, it will then release the moisture at that cold surface, thus the dew point, because it can't carry that moisture anymore, and then it can freeze, it can cause mold growth, it can cause rot, and then if that air, if you have a porous attic, it can get back into the assembly in the indoor space, the conditioned space, and then start to affect the health and safety of the occupants. And so that is why getting that boundary right, think of it as a big bathtub or a spa or whatever. You're trying to get this assembly, which is called your attic, sealed on all sides, sealed at the bottom, with no penetrations or no possibility for convective leakage of moisture into that attic space, where it will condense and cause a failure.
Because air is a fluid. You can almost always use water as a corollary for air, right? When we're talking about the heating season, hot air rises. So you'd think about an upside-down tub if you're going to do that analogy. But the fluid analogy works very well. And what we're talking about when we're talking about a penetration in that ceiling plane, that top plane, of that top pressure plane, is that moist air that's laden with gaseous water, right, will get into there, and at some point during the season it will hit a point that's below the dew point and go from a gaseous water into liquid water, and that's where we start having problems. So what we try to do is we have a strategy. There are two things we want to do. The first thing is we want to try to make these assemblies so that that first condensing layer is not going to be below the dew point. So even if there is moist air in that assembly, it will just stay as gaseous water in the air, and during the change in the vapor drive, it'll dry back out. Now, what is that vapor drive once again? So vapor drive works very much like heat. Hot heat goes from a hot place to a cold place. It's the hot trying to warm up the cold. Vapor drive is when you have a higher concentration of vapor in one, and vapor is that gaseous water once again, going to a lower area of concentration, because nature likes balance. It's going always to try to get to balance. So that's what we're talking about. The vapor drive during the winter, it's more moist inside your house than it is outside of your house. Therefore, you're going to have vapor moving from inside of your house through your wall as gaseous water. Doesn't have to have an air path to do that. It's actually just going to move through the sheetrock and through whatever you have into the wall, and will need a way to dry out. And there are two ways to have that happen. And one way is to add ventilation to make sure that there is drying potential in one, if not two, directions in the way the assembly is built. And we've talked about that before, and we'll talk about that more when we get back to walls. But we also want to make sure that we have a lot of air moving by that surface so that we can have a drying potential realized in that ventilation.
And so with that, you know, we've alluded to this before, and we've talked about this, it being that the stack effect inside of a house. So that's that propensity for warm, buoyant air to try to push out of the assembly, and usually that carries moisture. And so stopping that from doing so, you know, short-circuiting that effect by keeping it out of the attic is what is crucial here. And then with that, you know, what goes against that or can exacerbate that as well is when they do put a heating and cooling system, even ductwork, into that space. And currently
– which is illegal, by the way, just pointing that out.
It's against code.
It's against code.
It is currently against code to do that type of thing.
But we see it anyway.
Well, we see it in a lot of historic housing stock. Even, you know, people just – because they say, well, I have no other room to run these things. So where else am I going to run it? As soon as you do that, though, most ductwork is going to be – at least 20% air leakage is going to be coming out of that ductwork. And even if you're very fastidious and you seal everything up, you're still going to have about 5% of leakage. What that is leaking, though, is indoor air. And so if it's leaking indoor air into that space, once again, it's going to have moisture, but it's also depressurizing the interior space again and then drawing more of that air into the leaky attic. So it's accelerating the stack effect, and that's what you're trying to avoid. So whatever you can possibly do, do not design a building that has your mechanicals in that space. Or if you do have them in there and you upgrade your system, get them out of that space. That's just really important.
And there's a third option. If there's enough space, you can actually bring part of that attic into the thermal envelope so it's no longer part of the attic, right? Mm-hmm. And we've done that. That those houses in Stowe that we saw, there was a hot air furnace in an unheated attic. And the fix was, because there was nowhere else to put this, to build a little insulated house around that thing, exactly. Actually bringing that space into the thermal envelope.
And in one way we knew that worked is because the homeowner sent me a picture of the row of townhouses where these were, and every other townhouse had huge icicles on it. Except for his.
After the work was done.
After the work was done. So he was just so pleased with that. So that it does work. It is more expensive, but if there's no other option, then that's what you're going to have to look at.
Well, it's less expensive than building an addition to the house to put that mechanicals system in if you don't have room to do it elsewhere in your house.
And by placing it up there, usually it's about a 25% efficiency loss by having your mechanicals in your attic. So, you know, you're losing money right there. So when you're designing this or you're trying to make a retrofit, I mean, those calculations should be part of the equation, literally.
There are some mechanical systems that are designed to be outside, like roof-mounted heat recovery ventilation systems and whatnot, but those have already baked in the efficiency losses when they're giving you the efficiencies. These other systems that are just regular boilers or hot air, forced hot air systems, those should never be in a cold attic, and neither should the distribution ducts or pipes. That's just a bad idea.
So with that, we've talked about the fact that you have to understand what type of roof system you have, what type of attic space you're going to have, making sure that that boundary between the living space and the attic space is airtight and not just hopefully airtight, faith-based air sealing.
visual inspection of your air leakage.
Yeah, you want to make sure that it's not leaking because you will have issues.
Which means a blower door test.
Yes, and then with that, you're going to then want to determine what type of insulation you're going to use. Some people still like to use fiberglass, whether that's bat insulation or blown-in fiberglass.
Or spider.
Spider insulation, yep. With that, you could use dense pack cellulose, loose fill cellulose, rock wool, foam. You know, it doesn't matter. I mean, whatever type you're using, just know the different R values and what type of assembly and what performance level you're looking for.
And you have to know based on the make. So when Jim and I talk about how an assembly is built up, we usually count the layers and talk about the permeability. The permeability is how moisture moves through it. So let's start from the inside. We're at the inside. We hit sheetrock. Through the sheetrock, we hit the underside of the rafters. There's 15 inches of cellulose in there. After that, it's just a cold roof. That's one assembly, right? Then you have a cold assembly where you have sheetrock, and then you go to an air barrier, and then you go to the underside of the scissor truss, say, or a truss, and then you have more. Then you have cellulose, and then you've got a spray foam, and then you have OSB or another sheathing, and then you're at your shingles. That's how we talk about assemblies, and we talk about the R value of each of those and the permeability of each of those assembly bits, the cellulose, the spray foam, and whatever. And then we can look at in what climate those things are appropriate and what ratios of, say, a spray foam to cellulose you'd need in order to protect yourself against that first condensing layer and to make sure that you have vapor open assemblies.
And so with that, this brings us, you know, once you've identified what type of insulation you want to use, some people will say, well, you know, I'll just spray foam everything and that'll take care of everything. But where we see failures in that is, once again, not having that ventilation above the foam, thinking it's a hot roof, everything's going to be fine, but you still have that vapor diffusion through framing members where it may not show a moisture problem. problem or a rot problem today, but it's already starting to happen. It just takes years for it to show up, and then it's going to be really expensive to fix. Then also what we could have is when you're looking at the type of insulation you're going to go with is when you use foam, if the framing members are joined together and there's even an eighth inch gap or less, but you look at a lot of linear footage of that gap, you're going to get convective moisture transport through that assembly. And we've seen too many of these failures like this. And it's small, so you don't think it's significant. But when you have to pay the bill to have everything torn apart, you realize, and then put back, you realize how significant that is. So identifying that is really, really important. Some people think, well, then I'll just use like a SIP panel and just get really thick insulation outboard.
Structurally insulated panel. That's one layer of OSB with some insulation foam between it, and then another layer of OSB. It's kind of a sandwich.
And they would also try to do this, which is possibly getting really thick EPS on top or a different type of insulation. Just say, okay, I'm going to have this really, really thick, a lot of insulation. I don't need to vent it because it's never going to cause an ice dam issue. Granted, it may not leak from the inside of the building out, but see, snow is also an insulator. Snow will have an R value of R1 to 2 per inch. And if you get a 10 inches of snow, you could have as much as an R20 insulation blanket on top of your roof. So what does that do? It allows for that last part of the roof surface underneath the snow to heat up and create a space underneath that to be above freezing, and then it causes the snow to start to melt, become liquefied, and then when it comes back out to the eave, it refreezes, causes the icicle, the ice dam, the water backup, and failure once again. So in a region where you have the requirement of a 50-pound snow load, ground snow load, or higher, you will have this issue. You have to respect this, because otherwise you're going to have a failure with your roof. And in Vermont, there's only a small region on the western side of the state along Lake Champlain that has a 40-pound ground snow load. Everywhere else in Vermont, it's 50 to 70 pounds. So we have to say we've got to look at this, we've got to respect it, and we have to make sure the ventilation is in place to transport the moisture away from the assembly. Otherwise, once that dew point happens, we're going to have that refreezing, and it's going to be an issue. So if we need ventilation, we have to figure out how much ventilation we're going to need and how do we achieve that ventilation. And in the industry, there's a code minimum of usually 1 square foot of actual ventilation space for every 300 square foot of roofing. Some will default to as low as every 150 feet of square footage of attic space, and then require for each one of those 1 square foot of actual ventilation space. And so it sounds a little complicated, but just say you have a 20 by 30 square foot building, that's 600 square feet of space, or let's say you have a 1500 square feet of attic, you're going to then need 5 square feet of ventilation space. That 5 square feet is going to be comprised of your soffit vents and then some type of a ridge vent or gable vent. But you have to make sure that any exhaust ventilation you have does not overwhelm or surpass that of the intake. Because if you do, you set up a negative situation. I mean, you can have more intake ventilation at the lower part of the roof, but you don't want to have more exhaust. Some people try to achieve that with these nice little solar-powered ventilation fans that they put in their attic, and they think this is great. Well, when you over-exhaust that space, you're creating that depressurization once again. It's going to start drawing the indoor air out, if you have a porous attic, of course, into that space, and exacerbating the problem once again and causing more mold issues and condensation issues and everything else. And so you have to make sure that you're doing the correct calculation and putting the ventilation in the right space. Also, Chris, what do we see often with the soffit ventilations? It's there. You've got this linear soffit vent, but something's on top of it over the years.
Yeah. Something's on top of it.
Well, they've painted over it.
Oh, yes. Yes. We have seen soffit vents close up. We are both big fans of non-active ventilation, right? We want passive ventilation. If you're going to start doing powered ventilation like these whole house cooling fans, these like 4 foot wide fans that are supposed to draw in cool air during the summer to cool your house off, that is way too much for actually. Usually what's happening with those systems is that the gable end vents or the ridge vent are just not up to the CFM, the cubic feet per minute that these fans are blowing. So you get all kinds of weird stuff going, and it pushes back down into your walls. It can push back down to your house. We've seen seen houses that had vermiculite in the attic that had those things, and it was pushing vermiculite, which can have asbestos in it, back into the house. So if you're going to be venting a roof, or if you have a roof ventilation problem, get in contact with people like us. You can call us 802-244-1777 to talk to us on the show today. You can send us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com. But don't start adding mechanicals that are powered for venting a roof, because when a roof, let's just talk about a vented cathedral ceiling, right, with a 1.5-inch gap that goes from the soffit all the way up to the ridge. When the sun is on that, that has between 20 and 200 air changes per hour that's happening, just because the air is getting heated up and its stack effect is pushing it up and out. And that all has drying potential, and you don't have to add a powered ventilation system on top of that. They usually are just not very well thought out, and should only be used in situations where there's absolutely no other option.
Or what happens so often is you recognize a problem with your house and someone says, oh, well, let me just solve it with this Band-Aid fix. And you, with good intentions, but you not understand the dynamics of what's causing it.
House is a system.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, with that, you've got to make sure you have somebody who is on board with understanding the science appropriately and is helping you spend your money in the right way.
Yeah.
You know, as we said, building science is not going to respect your shortcuts or your best intentions or your beliefs.
Or your beliefs. I don't believe there's anything wrong up in the attic.
Exactly. And so with that, you know, you're not just putting an extra ventilation in there. You're not just going to try to solve the presenting issue with mold or whatever, because I've seen people, they'll come to us and said, you know, I had a lot of icicles last year. I had my roof replaced thinking that was going to fix it, and they're still there. Well, of course they are, because it wasn't the roofing material that was causing the shingles. And just because you put a slippery surface at your eaves, like metal, an apron,
to shed that bottom 3 feet of snow.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that you don't have failures still inside the attic where your sheathing is decomposing or becoming brittle or whatever. It's not just our climate, it's all climates. In the south, you could end up having, in the southern part of the United States, you could have your sheathing material becoming very, very brittle because it gets overheated. You can have, in our area, you can have some of that, because I've seen some of those roofs, or you can end up having what we see too often, rotting OSB, moldy, everything else like that, and you're going to have to get into a really big and expensive repair. And so getting this right and understanding what is causing the icicles in the first place is going to be moisture from somewhere. It's going to be that it's being transported or diffusing through an area, and you've got to be able to ventilate that out of the assembly. No matter how tight the assembly is, you've got to get rid of that moisture and have a way for it to escape.
Either passively through vapor diffusion, and as we were discussing before, or actively through ventilation, right? And so moisture is – The reason we get on top of moisture is that there are three types of activities that rot wood. We've got mold, mildew, and wood rot. Yep. These are all biological creatures that need three things in order to survive.
Temperature,
which happens to be right at the temperature we like to live at.
Yep.
Mold and mildew and wood rot all love 40 degrees to 90 degrees. They need an organic source.
A food source
is, yep, going to be your OSB. It's going to be your wood. It's going to be your plywood. We also then need moisture. So we can't control the fact that we live in a temperature zone that they also like. We all evolved in the same environment, right? So we can't get rid of the temperature thing. That's set. We can't get rid of the fact that we're building things out of organic material that are food for this thing. Yes, we could. We could do what they do in Europe, in the Netherlands and Germany, where they build everything out of concrete. There's no organic material in concrete. You're not going to get any mold in concrete. It's just super expensive and has what's known as a very high embodied energy, which means it takes a lot of energy to make a little bit of concrete. So the only thing that we can really control is the moisture, and that is where we are always focusing our attention to. When we were at that house that had ant issues,
yes,
the man from Oregon came and said, what you got to do is find the ant hills and take them out. And that is one way to do it. But there are always going to be ants. You can't
get rid of them all.
They're living in the middle of the woods. What are you, yeah. are you going to have like a full-time ant hunt going on? No. What you do is you remove the moisture, because what are those carpenter ants looking for? They're looking for nesting materials, and that is moist wood. So the only way to control any of this stuff is to control the moisture. And there are a couple of strategies for that. The best one being ventilate. Just make sure that that moisture has got a path that is reliable, that doesn't need power to work, and will reliably get rid of that moisture.
And in today's topic, what we're talking about is whether to vent a roof or not. That is a hot roof or a cold roof. You know, what is the best course of action? And one of the things we were talking about before the break is that making sure you do have enough ventilation. But when you get to a certain pitch on a roof, and the pitch is the slope, how sloped is it? Is it flat?
And we're given that in what's called a rise run,
yes.
right? So how many inches does the roof go up with a 12-inch run? So if you're going horizontal 12 inches and you're going up 6 inches, that's a 6-12 roof.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, with that, when the calculation that we gave before, which was roughly a 1 in 150 or a 1 in 300 square feet, which is saying that for every 300 square feet or as little as 150 square feet, you should have one square foot of actual ventilation space. And that, you know, when you actually share that space, you should have about 60% of that along the lower part of the roof, along the soffit, and 40% of that along the ridge area to make sure that, you're not exhausting more than your intake.
If you have a soffit and ridge system.
Exactly.
There's also gable end systems, which are less efficient. And some people try to put both in, which kind of doesn't work so well because
no.
the gables short circuit the working of the soffit and ridge system.
And a lot of people think, and you know, I got to admit, 20 years ago, I was thinking the same thing. Well, geez, if you already have gable vents and I'm putting a new roof on, I'm definitely going to put a ridge vent in. But then what happens is that ridge vent is short-circuited by the gable vent and vice versa. So it's not really – it's drawing out of one another. So you'll get like as close as you get to the actual gable vents, you start drawing air from the gable vent and up into the ridge vent, and you never really start drawing from the lower part of the roof, and thus you're not really – allowing the ventilation to happen.
Right. It's like having a straw where you're cutting holes in the middle of the straw.
Doesn't work as well.
Doesn't work as well.
So with that, if the calculation that we did get before, the 1 in 150 or 1 over 300 square feet, that works for roof pitches up to 612. But once you start to get
– but very importantly, from 312, right?
Oh, yes.
Lower than 312 pitch, you have a whole different ventilation scheme and odor.
Yeah, because we'll get right back to that. But with that, if we go up to a 7-12 to a 10-12 pitch, then you're going to end up getting into where you need 20% more ventilation than that original calculation. And if you get up to an 11-12 or above, and a lot of capes are 12-12s,
yep.
you know, so they're that steep or 45-degree angle, and you're going to have that kind of consideration. And so if once you get up there, you're going to need 30% additional ventilation to make sure that it's operating appropriately. And Chris did allude to the fact that, okay, if you get below a 3-12, your ventilation strategy has to change, because what happens is it becomes static. You don't have that same convective drive. And so I was in a situation where we're doing a roof half and 12. So really a half an inch.
Pretty much a flat roof.
Pretty much flat roof. And I thought, okay, can we still ventilate it? No, you can't, because it's not, the air will not drive unless you mechanically force it. And that didn't make any sense. Oh, we have a call right now.
Hi, this is Chris from House Calls Vermont. How can I help you?
Hi, this is James. I live in Virgins.
Hi, James.
I kind of had a question about insulating my house. It's built in 1960. I don't know the roof pitch, but it's quite shallow. And I don't have gable ends, meaning it has multiple angles on the roof.
Okay.
It only has the venting under the eaves.
Yep.
See, well, all the way around, but that's it. It's quite hot in the summer, and there's very little insulation.
Okay.
It's definitely dry up there, but I know I need to put more insulation in there, but I'm wondering what type, and I need to add more ventilation. So kind of, I don't think I could do a ridge vent just because of how the roof works. So
If you were to describe your house, is it a ranch? Is it a raised ranch? Is it a?
It's a ranch. It looks like a single story.
Okay, single story ranch.
Do you know the dimensions? The length and width.
It's pretty good size. 60. It's a wide house. 60 feet, maybe 25 feet deep.
Yep. Pretty standard size.
Excellent.
And what you mean by it doesn't have a gable end is that that's a hip roof, right? When you look at the house, there's no place where you could put a gable end roof because you have roof sloping down to the eaves all the way around the house.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. That's what we were talking about earlier, that hip roof. So those houses usually have a 312 pitch or a 3.5-12 pitch, so it's a relatively low-pitched roof. And you can have a ridge. It depends on how deep the hip is. If the hip is not very, very, very steep, then you would have, with a 60-foot long ridge, even if you took 20 feet off of either side, you'd still have, enough venting there for a softer ridge. And by saying that, you know that it's dry up there, it kind of indicates to me that it's already venting well. Right? So adding insulation would be air sealing, first of all. Adding insulation, you may not have to increase the ventilation. We'd have to take a look at it to give you definitive information for your house. But it sounds like adding insulation shouldn't change how well that roof is venting as long as the soffits are maintained when you put that new insulation in.
Right. The soffits meaning they're not plugged up at all.
Right. You gotta make sure that they are able to act as a venting channel, which means that from the soffit going up around and into the cold attic space, which then feeds the ridge vent, that would be clear. Now, there is something that Jim and I developed. We weren't the only people to develop it. We called it an energy curb or a wedge, which means that in the first foot and a half, from the outside of the house coming in on the roof, because the pitch is so low, it's hard to get a good R value out of something like a cellulose, which is what we'd recommend for the majority of the attic insulation.
Uh-huh.
So what you do is for the first foot, you put in a protective vent, a vent protector called a prop vent or something like that, that will make sure that your soffit to the cold part of the attic is maintained, so your venting is maintained, and then that first foot is filled with spray foam. And then after that, as long as you've properly done the air sealing on your attic flat, you can add up to 24 inches of cellulose, depending on how tall the attic space is. We like 24, but we've been in roofs where there wasn't enough room for that, so we went with 18 or even 16. But that's a very good number.
And let me add this real quick, is what's really, really important is you're about ready to fundamentally change how the house is performing since 1960. So this is a great time to not miss this opportunity of getting somebody who is well-versed in home performance and to look at this, perform an assessment, and make recommendations from there. It allows you to, one, ensure that your investment is going to go in the right place, but also you're able to tap into rebate monies that are offered by Efficiency Vermont if you use one of the contractors on their Efficiency Excellence Network or the EEN group of contractors. And so that's a great place to start. I make that recommendation. It's easy to find online and get somebody out there to take a look. Then with that, as Chris said, making sure that that attic flat is correctly air sealed and you didn't just add more insulation to it because it's not going to perform well. This is your chance to get everything correct and make sure that air sealing's done, making sure, as Chris said too, that the soffits don't get blocked, because I've seen that before where someone goes and adds more insulation, but they block the soffit. So it's like covering your mouth and expecting to still be able to breathe really well. And so you want to make go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that would make sense because the angle is quite shallow to kind of get in there, so there is not a lot of space right above the soffits there.
Yeah,
exactly.
So,
what would the insulation? I mean, it's very minimal. I think I would call it 5 inches of dust, basically.
Well, as long as that's cellulose, I'm okay. But that's why a home performance person should inspect that, because it could be from the vintage of the home. It could be vermiculite, and that could have asbestos.
I imagine it is. It's probably original, but I'm only guessing at that.
Yes.
But,
so, James, what we recommend is that if you want, you can send us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com, or go to efficiencyvermont.com and go to find a professional and just look up getting someone to come and do an energy assessment of your house to give you the right on the spot, looked at by a professional advice. The advice that we're giving you is based on your explaining it and our understanding of that, but you really need somebody's eyes on it.
No, okay. I understand that. I'm going to do that. Thank you for your help.
You're welcome, James.
Some ideas. Yeah, it's very interesting. I love your show.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good rest of your day.
And we have Sean from Montpelier. Sean, go ahead with your question.
Hello?
Nope, looks like Sean might have dropped off.
Please call back at 802-244-1777. If we accidentally dropped your call, we're sorry. But we were that's a great example there. You know, James calling in from Virgin saying, I know I want to do something with the house. Here are the specific and particulars. And Jim and I can give a good amount of information about generalities for that type of building. But there are specifics that are going on. Like James said, my attic space is dry. Well, it's possible that our eyes would see something that James didn't notice. Like there's some things that we would notice. For instance, when you're up in an attic, and if you're interested in learning more about this, please go to our YouTube channel and take a look at some of our audit eavesdropping. But the nails sticking through, if those are rusty,
yes.
You may not see mold anywhere or any other kind of indication of condensation in the roof. In the roof sheathing, but if the nails are rusty, that means that we're getting condensation in there, which means that the moisture content of the air in that attic is too high. It's not venting properly.
Or if you get up there during the winter, stick your head up there real quick on a frosty day, and the nails are frosty,
yep.
That's telling you something once again that there's
why are the nails all white and two times whiter than they're supposed to be?
Yeah, exactly. And so with that, so if you want to give us a call to ask us any of the questions regarding building science or renovation or even new construction needs that you have, it's 802-244-1777, 802-244-1777. And with that, one thing we were talking about James was first describing his roof system, I was thinking of a more traditional hip roof with not a long ridge. And so basically everything came to a point. So you think of the ventilation strategies you can use. You can use a product which is called either a box vent or a mushroom vent.
Yeah.
And that looks like a mushroom head. You know, it's usually round. It could be square. And that can go at the top of the ridge area. And on a traditional hip roof, if every ridge line comes to the same point, you could actually put one or two on each side to allow for adequate exhaust ventilation. But once again, you do the calculation. Like for James's roof, he had a 1,500 square foot home approximately. It's a single story, so the attic is going to be that same dimension. And with that, if you use the calculation, he's going to need about 6 square feet of actual ventilation, which is going to be divided up in between the exhaust ventilation and the intake ventilation. So it's an easy calculation, but it helps you get it right.
And if you wanted to know what the actual amount of air that one of those thin soffit vent strips gives you, a 24-inch long strip of that venting material gives you 9 square inches of venting. So, and that even the product says that. So if you have, you know, your roof rafters are 24 on center and you're doing this yourself, then you need to just make sure that you've got enough length of soffit and that it reaches the bays. I mean, one of the reasons Jim was bringing up these mushroom vents, and the only time we ever use these mushroom vents, is if you have a valley or a hip roof where there are actually
no other option.
Bits that are not able to reach a soffit because they start not at the edge of the building. They start in the middle of the building.
Now, we will get some very creative design professionals that really like the aesthetics of a multi-geometric planed roof.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it looks great, and it's complicated and everything else, but it's also nearly impossible, if at all,
to vent properly.
To vent.
Yeah.
And so you look, okay, well, then can we just build it anyway? You can. But expect to, as Chris said, start putting money in the swear jar, because when everything fails, you're going to need that money to replace it, because it will eventually fail. So you've got to respect our climate. You got to know what's going on and to make it right. And not just because you want to do it a certain way or design it a certain way, should you do that at the same time. I do deal with design professionals, and you try to dissuade them at times to not do something like that, because you're just setting up a failure that someone's going to have to pay for.
Absolutely. And we're getting to the bottom of the hour, and we've got a little overtime, so stick with us. But the last thing we need to talk about when talking about roofs – oh, we have a call coming through. Hello?
Hi, my name is Betsy. I'm actually calling more on behalf of my sister's house, and she is now just – has a whole lot of mold, and I'm thinking maybe it was the roof and a ventilation problem. But now that she has all that mold, do you have any recommendations of how to get rid of it, aside that she needs to deal with the roof, but it's permeated the house. So what do you do to remove mold?
So the first thing to do is to have a professional like Jim or I come in and discern where the mold is and where that indicates to us where the moisture is coming from, because mold is a moisture issue. So if the mold is only up in the ceiling on the attic plane, then it may be an attic ventilation problem. But if it's somewhere else, it could be the groundwater is not getting taken away from the building. It could be splashback because the wood part of the building is too close to the ground. There are so many things that it could be that really does say to me, get someone like Chris and Jim out there to take a look. So
So with that, you know, you want to look at this because you've identified the fact it's a health and safety issue.
Yep.
And also it's a durability issue because mold, it's eating the materials. And it may not weaken the actual rafters enough or the truss cords enough to cause a failure, but the actual in-between spots, the sheathing, those will start to degrade so much and become so weak that you can start to, if you have asphalt shingles, start to have premature shingle blow off because the nail fastening locations have weakened. So ascertaining where that's coming from and not just treating the mold and calling it good, because it's going to come back because somewhere there's a moisture and a heat source and everything else.
Right.
You've got to short circuit that.
Source.
Deal with that.
What's the source?
Then deal with the presenting issue of the visible mold and to make sure everything's safe. And there's different remediation companies out there and strategies to have that happen. A weird amount of that. But if it's also going to become an insurance claim, because sometimes the mold issues can become an insurance claim. I'm not advocating definitely doing that, but it's worth a phone call to see. You know, it doesn't cost you to have an adjuster come out and take a look to see what they might recommend. But there are some really expensive and lower cost methods of actually dealing with the mold that you can implement.
And it comes to mind, was this mold something that started showing up after somebody had done something to the house, right? Was the house not moldy before then?
Yes. Well, a porch was put on, like a porch, and then it was closed in, and that got a little bit leaky.
Mm-hmm.
She's also thinking maybe some of the old windows that haven't been replaced. We're not quite sure, so your advice to get a professional to check that out is too. But in the meantime, it really has permeated the whole house to the point that she's thinking she has to move.
I would definitely consider moving and finding out what your options are, because mold is just bad for health.
And I would say definitely if she does have a homeowner's insurance policy, contact them.
About getting compensation for housing.
Yeah, and that'll start with a site assessment.
Yeah.
So get that done. Do your due diligence there. And then also if you want to email us, we can help you find a professional in your area that can help assess what's going on and what the strategies would be to prepare.
Where did you say
that.
The house was?
Well, she's out of state, so that's a little bit of a problem. But just getting the information and the steps to take is really helpful from you both.
Sure thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling, Betsy.
Thank you very much for your answers.
Yeah, have a good rest of your weekend.
Bye.
So the last thing we want to talk about, we're coming up against the end of the show, but is roof, right? The shingles. When do I need to just have shingles replaced, and when is it more important to have a building science professional look at it beforehand? And the answer is anytime you have a slope, okay? You've got a cape. The cape has a flat, but it also has those slopes with the knee walls. That's a house that should get looked at, because it's when you're replacing those shingles is the first, best, and most inexpensive way to upgrade your cathedral ceiling insulation and ventilation package. And if you just call a roofer, most roofers are really going to come out there and not look at the various building science things, but want to give you new shingles, which is their job. But it's the only time. So if you have a cold roof that's just, you know, like mine was a raised ranch, there's no building durability issues with just taking off the shingles and putting new shingles on. Do yourself a favor. Never have them put shingles on top of shingles, even if it saves you money. It's just a bad idea.
And the call that Chris and I don't want, and we said this before, is the one where you do replace the roof and you say a year later you give us a call and say, I had it replaced last year, but I still have issues. And then that opportunity that could have been in exercise is now missed. And so without taking the roof back off again. So
and usually the cost multiplier for doing something again when you just did it is something like, you know, three times the cost. So if we were to, if you had a cape or a cathedral ceiling and something had to be done and you don't find out until after the new roof is on, you're going to have to take that roof off and do the work and then put that roof back on. So you're tripling your cost by not engaging someone like Jim or I to come and take a look.
So we're coming up on the end of our show for this week, but keep in mind on October 30th, Saturday, we're going to have a remote show that's going to be at Sticks and Stuff in St. Albans.
Woo-hoo!
So we definitely invite you to come out with your questions and also to become somebody who might buy something in the store as well. We would love to see you out there. And in the meantime, what Chris and I, you know, we want to make sure if you're doing a DIY project that you're certainly going to have great results, and DIY should stand for do it yourself, not destroy it yourself. So we want to make sure we avoid those issues for you if at all possible. So feel free to, once again, email us at what address again?
Housecallsvt@gmail.com. And you can also go and check out our audit eavesdropping, our interviews with industry specialists about different equipment and materials, and our YouTube live shows youtube.com/c/housecallsvermont. Until next week, this is Chris West.
And Jim Bradley.
Have a good week.
Bye, everybody.
And that is House Calls Vermont, presented by WDEV with host Jim Bradley and Chris West. Each week, new topic specific to building or renovating in the Green Mountains. And they take your calls as they did today. They'll be back again next Saturday at 12:30 right here at WDEV. You can listen to the podcast of the show, though, at WDEVradio.com. House Calls Vermont brought to us by RK Miles, a third-generation family-owned business. Proud to be your local building materials supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. Poly Construction, for over 30 years, known for anything construction. Big or small jobs, one call does it all. POLLIConstruction.com. Ken Libby of Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor at 802-793-2002. Curtis Lumber with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at CurtisLumber.com. Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com. And Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems for all things basement-y, northernnefoundations.com.